You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, September 21st, National Park Service historian Beth Parnitska delivered a talk on the Chancellorsville campaign and battle. Fought in 1863 over the first 4 days of May, Chancellorsville pitted Robert E. Lee's 60,000-man Army of Northern Virginia against Fighting Joe Hooker's 134,000. Amazingly, Lee was able to defeat Hooker. Was Chancellorsville truly Lee's masterpiece? Here's Beth Parnitska.
Well, firstly, thank you then for your patience. Those couple minutes, now we have a slideshow. Also, I wanted to say thank you for having me here, of course, for inviting me to come speak about one of my favorite topics. So if you ask anyone around the park, I love to talk about Chancellorsville. So thank you not only for the opportunity, but also for the subject matter. And so today we'll be looking at the Battle of Chancellorsville. I'm really thrilled, too, that you all are going to go see the battlefield very soon. I think you'll really enjoy it. If not, I do supervise the building. If you have any complaints, let me know. Otherwise, I also, in my talks, because I am a battlefield historian and because I lead tours, I love to have some kind of interaction. So if any of you ever feel like speaking up when I'm asking a question, feel free, by all means. It makes things more interesting. But so my first question or thought to look at for now is, what are some of our modern perceptions of the Battle of Chancellorsville? So I know you guys have a bit of a background in the Civil War, that you visit battlefields frequently, and so I'm sure you all have some ideas about Chancellorsville. So anyone want to take a guess at some of their ideas about Chancellorsville? What's most famous about it?
Lee, outnumbered 2-1, manages to pull off a victory.
All right, so there we go. What was that?
Jackson.
All right. Okay, yes, certainly. We have Lee outnumbered 2-1, still pulls off a great victory. And then we also have Jackson, of course. So those are going to be probably the two most common responses, the two largest perceptions of the Battle of Chancellorsville are one being that it's a stunning Confederate victory against long odds, and then the other being Stonewall Jackson. Not only because he's mortally wounded there, but also because he pulls off quite a brilliant flanking maneuver during the course of the battle. So those are what most people know about Chancellorsville. But there's a couple things to consider as we go along. One being, and this is just something to think about as we go on, how much did Jackson achieve with his flank attack? And then how much does it impact the war and the battle when Jackson is gone after his wounding? The other being really the title of my talk here, Lee's Greatest Victory. What makes this such a stunning Confederate victory? What is it about Lee's actions here and about what takes place on this battlefield that makes it to be considered Lee's greatest victory? And so with that, we also have to start off with some very broad questions of how do you define a victory? How do you know you've won? It seems like a pretty basic question, right? Well, obviously, Beth, if you hold the field and you beat off your enemy, then you've won, right? But how much is that victory worth? Does it achieve your objectives? Does it matter so much if you've won, if you take more casualties than your opponent? What if you retain possession of the field, but you have a broken force? And these are questions, of course, that can be applied to just about any Civil War battlefield that you go across. But here at Chancellorsville, I think it's particularly noteworthy simply because of its reputation as such a great Confederate victory. But so let's take a look as we go through as to just what are these elements that create Lee's greatest victory, if it even is. So the campaign certainly didn't begin as Lee's greatest victory. It actually looks quite the opposite. So can we have the first slide change?
And which one do I push, this one here?
The right arrow.
This one?
Yes. Okay. So here we see the person who actually initiates this campaign, Joseph Hooker. So I've seen some chuckles. What do we know about Joseph Hooker?
He's a braggart.
He's a braggart. All right. That is one of the things he is most known for, among another response, which I won't get into at the moment. He's what?
He's a drinker.
He's a drinker. All right. So Hooker's also famous for his camp lifestyle. He has the most rowdy camps, and his soldiers are actually very proud of the style that Hooker begins with. But so he's known for being a braggart, someone who's a little arrogant, and for someone who can't keep a calm camp. Interesting perceptions of Hooker. I note that none of you said he's a brilliant military commander. It's probably not a good sign for him. But at the moment, at the onset of this campaign, Joseph Hooker is an outstanding general, in the sense that he has taken a very broken force following the Battle of Fredericksburg. Can you imagine being in the Union Army? That Union Army is facing some of the greatest demoralization and in the middle of winter. And so through the course of the winter and early spring, Joseph Hooker patches this army back up, and so that by spring, he has an effective fighting force to use. That's no small feat. And part of that, I have to say, is because he's such a braggart. If your army commander walks up in front of all the troops and says, "Well, guys, maybe we'll make it this time. Maybe we'll win this battle, I think." Is that going to inspire you? No. But if you're Joseph Hooker and you walk up saying, "My plans are perfect, and when I start to carry them out, may God have mercy on General Lee, for I will have none," are you going to have some confidence in yourself?
Sure.
Yeah. So I think that's all part of Hooker's plan, though it's also part of his personality. He rises to command simply, in many ways, by thinking that he's really great. But again, he does pretty well to this point. He also says, while we're on that braggart idea, "The rebel army is now the legitimate property of the Army of the Potomac. They may as well pack up their haversacks and make for Richmond. I shall be after them."
Wow.
So these are some pretty bold statements to make at the very onset of your campaign, when you've never won a battle yet as an army commander. What on earth would motivate Joseph Hooker to make these kind of statements? Well, if you take a look at your first map, and we also have a slide for this. Take a look at your first map. Now, if you all are familiar with the Battle of Fredericksburg, which it sounds like you may have heard a little bit of it before, you might realize that one of the most difficult things that Ambrose Burnside had to face in December of 1862 is crossing the river. That the delay of the pontoon bridges almost entirely doomed his campaign. So when you keep that in mind, take a look at the very ambitious campaign that Joseph Hooker is looking to launch. He's got a huge flanking maneuver in which he is going to leave the Falmouth area. So you see that little dot, Falmouth, right across the Rappahannock River, where you see all of the arrows seem to be leaving from. That's about where the Union Army is at the onset of this campaign. They're clustered on the opposite side of the town of Fredericksburg. Hooker proposes to send his men on this wide march around the Confederate Army, crossing two rivers in the process, and coming in around the backside of Lee. He's going to get into Lee's rear and force him either to retreat or fight in such a position where he's basically trapped between the two sides of Hooker's army. It's a pretty brilliant plan in many ways, especially if he can pull off that flank march. And so this is only part of it. The other part of his plan is to send his cavalry on a wide sweeping movement to the south to cut off Lee's supply lines. So he's sort of delivering two punches against Lee, one being trapping the army with his infantry and then cutting off his out of supplies with his cavalry, which means in that sort of situation, Lee would almost certainly be forced to retreat back to cover his supply lines and move further south. So on April 13th, Hooker sends off his cavalry. They need a head start, certainly, for moving all the way around the army and cutting those lines to the south. Unfortunately, we're not going to get much time to talk about the cavalry. I think it's enough to say, however, that they don't really do much. They try, but they don't really accomplish anything. It would have been a grand piece in Hooker's puzzle, but it didn't work. But on April 27th, Hooker steps off the rest of his forces. These wide flanking columns that you see all of these arrows converging around, they're going to cross the Rappahannock River up at Kelly's Ford, and and then the Rapidan River in two places, so they don't have as much of a traffic jam. And they're sweeping in near Chancellorsville. By the time Hooker's intentions become very clear to Robert E. Lee. That's pretty cool, isn't it? He's just stolen a jump on Robert E. Lee. How many Union officers can say that? They've gone on this wide flanking movement around Robert E. Lee, come up in his rear, and succeeded. So when Hooker begins to make these statements, he does have a little bit to back it up. And Hooker's not the only one making excited statements. One of his soldiers in the 140th New York said, "Since we crossed the Rappahannock in such style, fording the Rapidan shoulder deep by moonlight, Hooker's stock is rising. He furnishes the brains, the army the legs, and I think legs have won. Hooker is a brick of the genuine kind." George Gordon Meade agrees. Now, and here you all are going to Gettysburg soon. You might realize that George Gordon Meade is famous not only for Gettysburg, but also for having a pretty towering temper. His friends lived in fear of him, actually, because of his temper. But he's actually pretty excited about Hooker's plans, Hooker's movements to this point. And he says to his fellow corps commander, Henry Slocum, "This is splendid, Slocum. Hurrah for old Joe. We are on Lee's flank, and he does not know it. You take the plank road toward Fredericksburg, and I'll take the pike, or vice versa, as you prefer, and we will get out of this wilderness." So if you can make the old googly-eyed snapping turtle excited, there's got to be something good about your plans to this point. Even the enemy agrees. So E. Porter Alexander, Confederate artillery officer, you guys have probably heard a number of quotations from him through your talks. He said, "On the whole, I think that this plan was decidedly the best strategy conceived in any of the campaigns ever set on foot against us, and the execution of it was, also, excellently managed up to the morning of May 1st. So even Alexander thinks this is a great plan. So why don't we remember Joseph Hooker as an excellent army commander? Well, if we advance to the next slide, we might see some of that. So if you're Robert E. Lee, you've now been placed in this very difficult situation. By April 29th, you realize just what Joseph Hooker is doing. You can see that he is, in fact, sending his men on this flanking maneuver, almost coming into his rear. Meanwhile, a large portion of his forces are still in Fredericksburg, ready to cross the river and, again, basically squish Lee's army between the two sides of Hooker's army. So if you're Robert E. Lee, what are your options? You don't have very many, do you? You can retreat, right? Which is exactly what Joseph Hooker wants you to do. You can fight, but the ground really isn't that favorable to you. You haven't chosen the ground yourself. And if you don't act very quickly, Joseph Hooker is about to trap you between the two sides of his army. But, as a fellow officer has said about Robert E. Lee, his name might be Audacity. He has options, mainly because sometimes Robert E. Lee just makes them for himself. So because he is such an audacious commander, he is not willing to simply let his army be trapped. But he's also not willing to accept the idea that his army must retreat without fighting a battle. Speaking about demoralization earlier, how demoralized do you think the Confederate Army would be if they retreated, if Robert E. Lee retreated in the face of a Union commander without even firing a shot? It's horribly demoralizing. And so Lee knows that he can't afford to do that. But so somehow he has to shape a victory, or at least a fight out of this, a fight where he has a fighting chance. Otherwise, he's doomed. And so, although we know how this story ends, mainly from my title and I'm sure your background knowledge, I think it's interesting to understand at this crucial point, right on, say, the evening of April 30th, nearing to May 1st, how does Hooker go from exuberance, success, in the eyes of everybody, to being a broken man in the course of about 3 days? How is it that Lee goes from a point where he's almost trapped to winning what many people would cite as his greatest victory? What happens in the course of these next 3 days? Of course, I hope you're all looking at me going, "Well, Beth, that's what you're here to tell us." But if we switch to the next slide, we'll start to see where things start to fall apart, or at least where people cite that things begin to fall apart. So if we remember part of Meade's quote here, it said, You, being addressed to Slocum, you take the plank road toward Fredericksburg, and I'll take the pike, or vice versa, as you prefer, and we will get out of this wilderness. So the plan, part of Hooker's plan at this point, has been to get out of what's called the wilderness of Spotsylvania County. It's about 70 square miles of dense woods. Trees aren't much taller than about 20 feet or so, which allows a lot of undergrowth to grow up in between. If you go to Chancellorsville, you'll notice that most of the woods are a lot taller than what I've just described, that it's a much more mature forest. So when you go there and you're looking at the fields and the woods, remember that it all would have been much smaller and much thicker and much worse, actually, to try to walk through. And so Hooker doesn't want to fight here, much like any general who actually has the advantage of numbers. And so Hooker's goal, again, is to press out toward Fredericksburg. And so he's going to do so on the three main roads that go into Fredericksburg. So he sends his men on the three main roads, which you'll see on your map being labeled as the old Orange Turnpike, modern day Route 3. You guys will probably drive on that when you go to Chancellorsville. The old Orange Turnpike is the main road. It goes almost directly from Chancellorsville, which, by the way, is just a large house at a crossroads. It becomes federal headquarters, but goes straight from Chancellorsville straight into Fredericksburg. There's another road you see on your map just below that one, just again the turnpike being sort of the center road. The Orange Plank Road goes right beneath it, but you see it kind of curves down and then curves back up into the turnpike. So you've got the Orange Plank Road, the Orange Turnpike, and then we have one road above where you see the big words May 1st, that is the River Road. So it kind of goes up north toward the river, winds around. There's almost, okay, so you have the River Road, which winds all the way along the river into Fredericksburg. So there's a bit of a problem straight from the onset that you might be able to see from your map already, is that these roads don't go in the same pattern, which means that your troops will be advancing at different rates. What's worse is that between each of those roads is the wilderness. And so although Joseph Hooker makes a very interesting assumption when he sends his men out, it becomes impossible. He assumes that his men will be able to advance together and to keep in communication with each other as they go forward. Now, since their roads diverge, and since there's woods in between, this really becomes impossible. But even in that sense, everything should still be fine, because he doesn't expect to encounter any Confederates until he gets much closer to Fredericksburg. So he sends, and the troops that you'll see out there, he sends about 10,000 troops with George Gordon Meade up on the River Road to the north. So you see them sort of in a train along the north. And then he has about 5,000 with George Sykes, tardy George Sykes, on the Orange Turnpike going straight in. And then he has about 13,500 with Henry Slocum down on the Plank Road. Now those are interesting numbers. He sent the smallest group on the main road, sent the largest group on the southernmost road that sort of bends around and in, and is under Henry Slocum. So things begin to get difficult, however, for these troops, as you can see on the maps. They're all advancing at once. They have some traffic in getting out on their roads, but after a while, they're all able to start pressing out toward Fredericksburg. But individually, they start to encounter some problems. Some of them do. George Meade, to his credit, has no problems as he goes along. There's no traffic on the River Road. There's no one defending the River Road. It's quite open. If you drive on it today, it's much the same. No traffic. But you have George Sykes, who you can see already on your map, is encountering some resistance, Confederates, before he ever expected them. You have Henry Slocum, who doesn't seem to have much opposition directly in his front, but has already prepared for it, and has actually thrown out his skirmishers and thrown his men out into a line of battle just at the sight of Confederate skirmishers. So how fast do you think he's moving through the woods? Not very fast. And so this goes back to that idea of Lee's audacity. This is a combination of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, unwilling to be squished between the two sides of Hooker's army. Instead of waiting to meet their opponent on his terms, or instead of retreating and demoralizing their army, Lee and Jackson have decided to split their forces, much as Hooker has, leaving some men in Fredericksburg basically to be distracted by the distraction that Hooker has left, and sending the rest of his men out to the west to meet this attack. which then puts Joseph Hooker into a bad position. Because now he's facing Confederates much sooner than he expected, while his army is divided into multiple pieces, and small pieces at that. George Sykes on the plank road, or on the turnpike, excuse me, is facing 13,000 troops with only 5,000 men. That really starts to make Hooker's benefit of having the greater numbers seem not to be helping him very much. And so Hooker starts to get reports back in from his men, from George Sykes particularly, who said, "I was completely isolated from the rest of the army." And he is. He's not only isolated from the other branches of the Union Army, he's got woods between him, but then also what you might see if you look at the plank road here, you can see that there are actually Confederates advancing past Sykes's position on the turnpike as they move along the plank road, which means all they have to do is turn and look to the north, and what will they see?
His flank.
His flank, exactly. George Sykes is about to be outflanked, again, by forces that greatly outnumber him. If you're Sykes, what do you do? You have some reinforcements, but they're not coming up very quickly. What can you do except send these panic messages back to Joseph Hooker, who's back at headquarters, now receiving dispatches? His men are isolated. They're not communicating with each other. They've got Confederates, not only in their front, but also in their flank. This wasn't supposed to happen. His plans are already falling apart, but plans fall apart in every battle, don't they? So Hooker should be able to react to this, right? And he does, in a way that most people will criticize him probably until the end of time. He pulls his men back from their position. Now, historians have, basically from the time that this happens, been pulling apart this decision. To Hooker, this is a smart move, and he says so. He confronts who is essentially second in command at this point, Darius Couch, who's the commander of the Second Corps of the Union Army. And he says, "It is all right, Couch. I've got Lee just where I want him. He must fight me on my own ground." To Couch, that doesn't make any sense. He said, "I retired from his presence with the belief that my commanding general was a whipped man." So already we see there's a bit of disagreement here. George Meade, again with his towering temper, is absolutely furious. He says, "If we can't hold the top of a hill, how do we expect to hold the bottom of a hill?" Now there is some high ground around the Chancellorsville clearing, which is where these men end up clustering. But at the same time, they're handing over the initiative to the Confederate forces. So although they're taking up a defensive position, and although they're taking up ground of their choosing in some ways, they're handing over the decision-making capability to the Confederates. And so there are really two camps as to whether or not Hooker loses it right here. Many historians will say this is exactly where Hooker loses it. If you ask Hooker, though, in the post-war years, he says that actually he didn't lose it right here. If given the same opportunity and the same choice, he would do it again. Why? Well, what's the last battle to precede this? Battle of Fredericksburg, right? And what happened in the Battle of Fredericksburg? The Confederates took a... What?
The Confederates had the high ground and the cover of the wall.
Right, the Confederates had the high ground and the cover of the wall. All right, and so from holding that defensive position, they simply allowed the Union Army to break themselves against that defensive position, right? So there is some strength in the defensive. If you study military tactics of the time, you've got to have an overwhelming force to break a force that's on the defensive, right? Or you've got to hit very strategically. Which means there is some strength in taking up this strong defensive position that Hooker undertakes to do. At the same time, though, he's not taking a number of things into account. One being that Ambrose Burnside in the Battle of Fredericksburg had very limited options. He didn't have the sort of creative alternatives that Lee and Jackson would have at this battle. But he also didn't have quite the strong position that the Confederates did. So although he has a defensive position, it's not as defensible. He does have still the strength of numbers, but he's facing off against a very audacious foe. So the battle, in this sense, I would say, is still a little bit up in the balance here. Because Hooker has on his side the strength of numbers. By the way, he has about 134,000 men total. By this point, he'll have about 70 to 80,000 concentrated around the Chancellorsville area. And we'll see just the extent of his lines on our next map. But he has this very sizable force here. The Confederates are boasting only about 44,000 in this area. They have 63,000 total. So So Hooker still holds the cards in the sense that he still has the numbers. But he, again, has given up the initiative to an opponent who's almost certain to use it. And so in that sense, he's made a very dangerous move. But as to whether or not it was the move that cost him this victory, it's probably something for you all to decide. But let's move on to the next slide. All right, so now it's the evening of May 1st. Joseph Hooker has pulled his men back into a defensive line that sort of bulges out around Chancellorsville. And if you do turn to your next map, which will be our next slide after this, you can see just what that line looks like. Lee and Jackson have concentrated their troops just opposite one side of that line. So they have nowhere near enough troops to actually oppose the entire line, but they are concentrated behind somewhat defensive lines just opposite the army. And so the evening of May 1st, we have a very classic scene. It's portrayed in countless images, sketches, paintings, and so forth. It's Lee and Jackson sitting on old cracker boxes, the old hardtack boxes, around a fire with a map, planning what they're going to do the next day. So we have one of those portrayals here in front of us. At this point, the cavalier Jeb Stuart rides in with the tidings that the right flank of the Union Army is up in the air. Now it's interesting at this point, before we continue with the story, to note the idea that Lee and Jackson are planning what they're going to do the next day. Remember that I just told you they were still outnumbered just about 2-1, even around the Chancellorsville area. They've seen heavy fighting, but their opponent outnumbers them and, has now taken a strong defensive position. But Lee is planning what he's going to do the next day. This, I think, is where Hooker does make one of his largest mistakes, is in not recognizing just how offensive-minded his opponent actually is. And so Lee and Jackson, again, will meet on their cracker boxes that evening to decide what they're going to do the next day. Jeb Stuart rides in to show them that indeed the right flank of the Union Army is up in the air, which means it's not defended very well. It's not turned back to meet any kind of opposition, and it's really just sort of ends along the turnpike. But in Joseph Hooker's mind, and in the mind of most of the commanders in the Army of the Potomac, that's not a problem. They're so far away from Confederate lines, they're not going to see any sort of attack. And that is one of the main problems that Lee and Jackson face when they're beginning to plan this move. It's because, quite simply, it's a long ways away. How are they going to get any of their forces in that position in order to be able to attack that vulnerability? But they use the help of some locals who know the back roads, who know a route which will allow them to get there. And so Jackson proposes to march 28,000 men in a 12-mile maneuver around Hooker's army in daylight, around a force superior to his. He'll leave Lee with about 14,000 men in the lines that they already had. Remember that I said that Joseph Hooker had about 70,000 men in the Chancellorsville area. 70,000 against 14,000? Is that even a fight? What about 70,000 against 28,000 men on a back roads march? Not really. They're taking a huge risk by proposing this move. We remember it as brilliant, mainly because it worked. But it's also a huge risk. Lee is essentially gambling with his entire army with this move. If it fails, we could see what scholars tend to refer to as the Battle of Annihilation. It's what these armies, commanders, are both looking for, that battle which will absolutely destroy their opponent. This could be it. But for either side, and I think that Lee sees that as well here, that if he can achieve this decisive blow, maybe he can destroy the Union Army. So he's gambling with pretty high stakes here, but I think it's for a solid objective. He sees that if he accomplishes his goal, the war, in many ways, will be over. It'll be worth the risk. If he doesn't, well, he does, so we don't really know. But we can tell that Lee is taking, again, a very huge risk here. And this is where we begin to see not only Lee's audacity, but also his tendency to take huge risks. But this plan that they make here is, again, one of the things that most people will cite as being the main reason that this is considered Lee's greatest victory. So let's see how it turns out. Can we change the slide? Okay, so And this map is very interesting for a number of ways. So we've been talking about Jackson's flank attack, but we're going to make a bit of an aside to take a look at how the lines have developed in the course of the day. So this map is the afternoon of May 2nd. So Jackson leaves on his march close to 7 o'clock in the morning. He's taking, again, 28,000 men on a 12-mile march. But if you're taking that many men, such a sizable force on such a trip, how on earth are you going to get away with it? How is Joseph Hooker, as even a slightly competent commander, and I think we've proven to this point that he is at least slightly competent, he's made this maneuver, how are you going to make this kind of a movement in the face of a slightly competent commander, at least a slightly competent commander, without getting caught? What do you need? A diversion, exactly. And so, happily, Hooker's men fall right into the trap. So Lee's men, where you see the name McLaws most particularly, stop number 4 on the driving tour if you take it, McLaws's men spend their entire day skirmishing. So they're moving forward just enough to get the attention of the Union soldiers, drive in their skirmishers, make them think that they're attacking, and then they pull back. And so it's really interesting if you read those accounts because the Confederates are thrilled because they're achieving their objective. They're keeping the attention focused on them, and the Union forces are also thrilled because they're, in their words, repulsing many determined attacks of the enemy. On May 2nd, before 5:15 in the evening, the battle is right where you see McLaws, Anderson, Lee, those folks. So if you take a look at your map, you notice that the lines have even sort of reoriented themselves. So Sickles used to be near where you see the words Chancellorsville, Plank Road, right up by Dowdall's Tavern there. It used to be a line that extended just along. What you see labeled here is the Plank Road. It's actually the Turnpike. It used to extend in sort of a straight manner all the way out to Howard. But because that's where the fight is, the line is bent, which means that by the time Jackson's attack hits, and you can see him in the upper left-hand corner there, by the time Jackson's attack hits at 5:15 in the evening, he's no longer attacking the flank of the army, he's attacking the rear of the army, because the lines have again reoriented to face Lee's troops. But they're still not strongly enough engaged to completely crush Lee. It's really a masterpiece of a diversion. But again, to return us to Jackson's flank attack, he marches again 12 miles all day on those back roads. You see the dotted line traces out his route before he finally hits it about 5:15. Now, what are you all usually doing about 5:15 in the evening?
Dinner.
Exactly. That's exactly what these troops are doing. They're cooking dinner. They're actually cooking their rations for the next 3 days so that they can follow up on the Confederate retreat. Bit of a bad move on their part. Because if you were eating dinner and 28,000 screaming Confederates interrupted, what would you do?
Run.
That's exactly what I would do. Would run for my life. And that's exactly what most of these men do. Jackson is able to completely roll up that flank. So the 11th Corps out there under Howard, most of them run for their lives. They'll put up a few in their defense. They will put up a few last-ditch efforts at holding their ground, which is actually pretty remarkable considering the circumstances. But in the end, there's really nothing that can stop Jackson's attack. His line extends for about a mile on either side of the turnpike. That'd be pretty hard to stop, when in some cases, that flank really only extended for about 500 yards. So 2 miles versus 500 yards, Jackson wins. So in this case, the 11th Corps, in many ways, will run, in many cases at least, run all the way back toward the Chancellorsville clearing. Some will be captured by Lee's men on the far other side. But in the process, of course, Jackson's troops, as they're trying to close in on the small front, will simply collapse in on themselves. So repeatedly collapse in, to fold into these Union soldiers. And so between that and the woods and the fact that it was dinner cooking, and these Confederates were hungry, Jackson's attack grinds to a halt by dark. By about 9 p.m., their front lines are just along where you see, I guess right above Chancellorsville, where you see the intersection of the Bullock Road and the Plank Road. And so I won't delve into this too much because for you all who are going to Chancellorsville, you'll get the tour of it. But it's at this point that Stonewall Jackson leads reconnaissance out in front of his troops because he's looking, he wants to continue the attack. He's had success to this point. He hasn't had the success level of that battle of annihilation that these men are looking for. And so he wants to press that attack into the evening. And so about 9:15 or so, he leaves his front lines looking for a way in which the Confederates can cut off the Union lines of retreat. As he returns to his own lines, he's accidentally shot 3 times by his own men. Again, details that I won't go into, but these men actually had, in many ways, a justifiable reason for firing. It's a lot of confusion. It's dark. They've just finished this flank attack. They don't know where everybody is. What they do know is that the Union forces are in front of them. And so when there's noise out in front of them in the dark woods, what are you going to do? You're going to shoot. And so Jackson, again, accidentally wounded, shot 3 times by his own men, has to be removed from the field, has his left arm amputated in the early morning hours of May 3rd. So now what? If most of this success has been built on the audacity of Lee and Jackson, what do you do now? And so if you take a look actually at our next map, you'll notice not only the sort of success that Jackson has had, but also that he's now in a bit of a tough spot. Or at least Robert E. Lee is. Jackson, again, removed from the field. Because Lee's men are still, they're not shown on this map, unfortunately, but they're still where you see that jagged line between Turnpike and Orange Plank Road. They're still in that position. And you see Jackson's men are all along, much further to the west along the Turnpike. That means Robert E. Lee's forces are divided in two. Joseph Hooker knows exactly where they are. And Lee has been deprived of the services of Stonewall Jackson. Lee, on the morning of May 3rd, is in a more precarious position than he has been likely at any point in the battle. And without his most trusted subordinate, what is he going to do? Well, to replace Stonewall Jackson, he brings in Jeb Stuart. Stuart is an interesting choice. He's a cavalry commander. So why would we bring in Stuart? Well, who else is going to fill those shoes? Jackson's closest subordinate officer, A.P. Hill, has been wounded in the same hour or so as Jackson. Now what? So there's two other subordinate officers, but both of them are new to their own commands, which means they're not really capable of filling Jackson's shoes quite yet. So who else can you turn to? Jeb Stuart has the reputation in order to command these men. He has experience commanding large bodies of forces, and he's known to keep cool in battle. In fact, during this battle, is anyone familiar with the song, The Old Gray Mare, She Ain't What She Used to Be? Okay, he's actually singing. He's made up his own lyrics. Old Joe Hooker, won't you come out the wilderness, to the tune of The Old Gray Mare. So he's singing this to his troops as the day's battle progresses. So in many ways, Stuart is an excellent choice because he does have that presence on the field and he does have that reputation. In another sense, though, he's a cavalry commander. And this is a tight quarters kind of fight. He doesn't have the room for the finesse that he likes to have with his cavalry or that Jackson even liked to have. There's no room, there's no time for the same kind of maneuver that we saw the day before, which means that May 3rd is going to be characterized by bloody hammer blow attacks. It's going to be, if you count these sort of things, the bloodiest morning in American history. For 5 hours, every second a man is going to be either killed or wounded. That's more than 17,000 casualties in the course of 5 hours. It's because of the nature of these attacks. And so if you take a look at this map, this shows us between 8 and 9 a.m., the morning of May 3rd. So you can see that the main goal for these two forces would be, of course, to rejoin themselves together. Stuart coming in from the west, Lee attacking from the south. They're able to reunite in a position called Hazel Grove. They're lucky that they can because Joseph Hooker used to hold that ground. It's high open ground. It's that one piece of the battlefield that stood between the two sections of Lee's forces. But in Hooker's mind, it's a salient. It's a bulge in his lines. It's a very bad defensive position. And so he pulls out of that spot because he sees it as a vulnerability. Now what happened, and Hooker gets an inordinate amount of censure, I guess, for this move. But why did he do it? What happened the last time he left a vulnerability in his lines? Complete disaster, right? He can't have that. He has to make an impregnable defensive line, and then Robert E. Lee's forces will break themselves against it. And so that's, I think, what's going on in Hooker's mind in this sense when he pulls his men out of Hazel Grove. As soon as his men are out, Lee and Stuart's men fill in. And together, they make a bit of an L, which, again, you can't see because Lee's men aren't on this map. But again, still, hammer blow attacks. It's the only thing they can do. And they're fighting in very bloody attacks, very difficult terrain, because they're attacking, in many cases, through the woods. And so some men will describe that they can't see more than 12 feet in front of them. They can't see their enemy. They're just firing because someone's firing at them. And so they imagine if their enemy can hit them, then they can hit their enemy, even if they can't see them. It's a very difficult position. But you can see here also that some men are having quite a time of it, though. The artillerists have set up close to 32 guns up on that position at Hazel Grove. It's a high open position, perfect artillery plateau. There's actually an account of a young artillerist who's backflipping every time that he pulls the lanyard, because this is an artillery versus artillery duel. They have a clear shot through to a place called Fairview, which is also on the map. You see it's just across from Hazel Grove, another open spot, which is where the Union artillery is. And so artillerists really enjoy artillery versus artillery duels. And so these guys are having quite a time of it on the morning of May 3rd. But the infantry is having a much more difficult time. So one of the main waves of attack that goes through the woods on the north side of the turnpike would be Ramseur's North Carolinians. So these guys see some pretty heavy fighting throughout the war, and here they see some of their heaviest. They're moving forward over men who have already taken a few steps forward and had to take a step back. Ramseur's men advance over at the top of them, in some cases stepping on them and so forth as they go forward. Those men are pretty bitter, so they shout at them, "You may double quick, but you'll come back faster than you go." They do fall back after an attack. So most of these attacks are sort of taking two steps forward, one step back, but they're still gaining ground, so they keep going. Stuart is on the scene, and he greets Ramseur's men with three cheers for Ramseur's brigade. "Men, you have done your duty." That depends on what you term duty. The 2nd North Carolina lost 214 out of 340 men. The brigade as a whole lost 623 out of 1,400. That's 45% casualties in these attacks. And so Ramseur's attack, in some ways, is very representative of the experience of the many other men who fought here on May 3rd. Ramseur asks of his men, "Is this all that's left?" And they say, "This is all, sir." And in tears, Ramseur says, "Men, I love you." Because what else can he say at that point? The slaughter at Chancellorsville ends up being the worst that most of these veterans have seen. Over and over in their accounts, they use the word slaughter, because they can't find another word to describe it. But in the end, these hammer blow attacks are rather successful, especially in conjunction with that artillery on Hazel Grove. A little after 9 a.m., Joseph Hooker is standing at federal headquarters at Chancellorsville, and you can see on your map that Chancellorsville is just behind Fairview. He's leaning up against a pillar at the Chancellor House, which is his federal headquarters, and a shell strikes that pillar that he's leaning against. Hooker is knocked down. He's unconscious and for a time is vomiting. He's the commanding officer of the Union Army. What do you do when you've lost the commanding officer of the Union Army? Well, you'd have to find a replacement, right? Second in command, that's why there's a chain of command in the Army. Except that Hooker doesn't give up command. So he's unconscious for a short time, regains consciousness, his officers prop him back up on his horse, try to show him off to the men. He's okay, but he's not. He's been vomiting. He's not entirely with it. He probably has a concussion at the very least, and he's still commanding the army for at least an hour. And so he's in no condition to command the army. Meanwhile, you can see the scene here. Everything is beginning to collapse in around him. By 9:45, Fairview, that strong Union artillery position, is failing. George Meade has a plan, though. He wants to exploit his position. You can see the north there, how the line sort of arcs above the Confederate line there. He's got a plan to outflank the Confederate forces. He goes in and meets with Hooker, but Hooker, again, still out of it, says no. By 10 a.m., again, Fairview is failing. The world essentially is collapsing around Joseph Hooker. And we have the next map for the next sort of phase of attacks here. Things, again, by 10 a.m., collapsing in around Chancellorsville clearing. That is when finally Hooker turns over command to Darius Couch, but he does so in an interesting way. So Couch finally sees that he might have an opportunity to do some real fighting here. But Hooker's words to him say, "I turn the command of the army over to you. You will withdraw it and place it in the position designated on this map." Couch is ready to fight, but he's been told, with essentially direct orders from commanders who may or may not be with it, that he is instead to withdraw his men. That's where you can see them starting to form a V between Alabac and Devens up there. They're forming that last line of Joseph Hooker's that is supposed to be the last defensible, impregnable position. Hooker's still keeping with that defensive mindset he's had to this point. So what sort of impact do you think it has on the battle that Joseph Hooker is wounded? I'd say quite an impact at this point. Of course, things are failing by this point, but perhaps it could have been salvaged if Hooker had not been out of it. So now again, we have to ask, at what point does victory start to slip out of your grasp? Is it still winnable for Hooker at this point? No, perhaps not. But has Lee perfectly won yet? Not quite. But Hooker begins the withdrawal of his army, or rather Couch begins the withdrawal of Hooker's army. There's one force left as their rear guard under the command of Winfield Scott Hancock, who turns to his subordinate officers and says, "Gentlemen, we are left to keep them in check until the second line is formed." One of his other subordinates, "General, whatever happens, I want you to hold this ground." His subordinate officer asks rather prudently, "Where are my reserves?" Hancock says, "None of your business. That is my business." What's Hancock saying? There are no reserves, exactly. We are the reserves. And so you can imagine that it's only a matter of time now before federal headquarters falls, and Hancock has to fall back himself to that last line. The scene at the Chancellorsville clearing is the federal headquarters is on fire. It's caught fire, and wounded are being removed from that position. As it's burning, Confederate troops are converging on the point. Robert E. Lee rides in triumphantly. One man said, "I thought it was from such a scene that men in ancient days rose to the dignity of gods." Has Lee achieved that success quite yet? Perhaps. Though, bad news rides in very soon after. Those guys left in Fredericksburg have broken through the lines, the Confederate lines that have been left there as well, and are heading west to try to bail out Joseph Hooker. They're Hooker's last hope at this point. But Lee is not fazed at this point. He's beaten 2-1 odds already, so he divides his forces yet again, leaves enough men to hold Hooker in place. It doesn't take much by this point. Hooker is, in many ways, a beaten man, a man stuck in a very defensive mindset. And Lee sends the rest of his forces out to meet this threat. He beats those men back at the Battle of Salem Church, reunites his forces, and plans a bloody attack for the morning of May 6th. A bloody attack because it's a frontal assault, because Hooker has such a strong defensive position. There's really no other choice for Lee if he wants to entirely beat Hooker's forces. Luckily for Lee, and perhaps for Hooker, there's no longer a Union army this side of the river by that point. Hooker has entirely retreated back across the lines despite all of his commanders voting to stay. And that essentially ends the Battle of Chancellorsville. Hooker returns to his lines opposite Fredericksburg. Lee also returns to Fredericksburg, though, with some big plans in mind. Within a few weeks, he'll be pitching the idea of an invasion of the North. He's gained a lot of confidence from this battle. But so, shall we switch to the next slide? Sorry. But I think it's important to think about what has been gained and what has been lost in the course of this battle. So before we can even begin to think about whether or not this is Lee's greatest victory, we have to finish up the story. So Jackson has had his left arm amputated. Early morning hours of May 3rd, he sent down later to a place called Guinea Station. It's a major train depot, hoping to send him all the way to Richmond. But the rail lines have been cut. Remember that cavalry? They finally did something. They cut the rail lines. So Jackson ends up in Guinea Station, where he hopes he can recover. But on May 10th of 1863, Jackson dies of pneumonia. So it's not even from his wounds, but instead from a disease that he likely had before he was ever even shot. His final words, you see, "Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees." But that only adds to the casualty totals for Robert E. Lee. The next slide. Lee has lost Jackson. He's lost about 13,000 of his men, which ends up being 22% of his forces. So that's less than 17,000 that Hooker loses, but still, 22% of his forces is losses that he can't afford to lose. And what has he gained? Has he gained any ground? He held his ground, which counts for something. The main victory, I think, that Lee achieves at Chancellorsville is simply morale. He's gained confidence not only in his men have gained confidence in himself. They've beaten 2-1 odds. Surely they can beat anything. What about Hooker? Poor other gentleman here. Has he won anything? Probably not. He's not really. He's begun to look awfully foolish, actually, as we sort of mentioned at the very beginning. Things started out very well for him, but they've since gone downhill. He's lost 13% of his forces in those 17,000 men, and also gained the scrutiny of high command, which means they're not willing to remove him from command because how many have they already removed? I mean, it's starting to look pretty bad for Union high command. They can't fire yet another general. But Hooker finds that he can't really do anything with his forces. He is the commander, but everything that he plans has to be approved by some higher force, which means he can't do what he wants with them. And so, as he's already chasing Lee to the north, he resigns his command. He figures out that's just what Union High Command wants him to do. He's succeeded by George Gordon Meade, that old snapping turtle. He takes command June 28th, already again chasing Lee to Gettysburg. To come back to Gettysburg, though, what is the most famous incident at Gettysburg, would you say? Pickett's Charge. What's one of the reasons that Lee gives for Pickett's Charge? He says it was all his fault, right? But why was it his fault? I heard something about Longstreet. Could you speak up again, sir?
He tells him don't do it.
All right, so Longstreet tells him don't do it, so maybe Lee should have known better. But after the fact, Lee's excuse was that he simply thought his men were invincible. Some of that invincibility was probably born here, gained here in that kind of confidence. So was that confidence even a good thing for Lee's forces? It's an important question to ask. So is this Lee's greatest victory? Has he achieved his objectives? Has he won? All of which questions I'd love to discuss with you further. But at this point, I'd say thank you all very much again for the opportunity. And welcome any questions. Yes. Well, that's precisely, exactly. Right, so the question for anyone who didn't hear is that Lee really had to engage, didn't he? What were his other options? As we looked at the very beginning of this discussion, he didn't have many alternatives. He couldn't retreat without, you know, losing the morale of his men. He couldn't fight on Hooker's terms. He had to fight on his terms. He didn't have many options. So I think that's a very valid point here, and I think that's one of the arguments that contributes greatly to the idea of this being Lee's greatest victory, is that he was handed some extremely bad circumstances. And not only did he make the best of them, but he turned it into a brilliant victory, using not only lots of military maneuver, but also just in winning at all, holding the ground, outmaneuvering his opponent, making his opponent retreat, even at whatever cost he had. You're right, he didn't have many choices, and of all of his alternatives and all of the potential outcomes that he could have had here, besides that battle of annihilation, which would have probably been one step above this, if he destroyed the army, Lee really did make the best of his circumstances, I would say. That's a very good point. Yes, sir?
Two-part question.
All right.
Lee's remaining force...
He was indeed. So you'll notice one name that I did not speak of at all during this time, except toward the very end, and that's James Longstreet. Longstreet's men are actually far to the south, and why Lee only has 63,000 here. Longstreet has two of his divisions to the south here at Suffolk, and they do rejoin the army, of course, because Longstreet plays such a large role in Gettysburg. They rejoin the army before Lee decides to leave for for the north, not yet knowing it's Gettysburg. But yeah, he is reinforced by that point. All right, so the question was about the type of vegetation in the wilderness area. So I said it was about 20 feet tall, mostly trees, of course, so it is woods. But what caused it, and just what does it look like again? So what caused it essentially is clear cutting of the forest. So One of the main industries in the area is furnaces, iron furnaces most particularly. So along the drive into our Chancellorsville, you see we have the ruin of one being Catherine Furnace. There's also Spotswood Furnace in the area that I know of. Many iron furnaces in the area. To feed those furnaces, you need trees. So most of the trees have been clear cut earlier. So what you have is second growth forest growing up. And I'm certainly no forestry kind of person, but without the large canopy of trees that you have, you get a lot of thick undergrowth, which means a lot of thickets, briars, just a mess, a real tangle of woods, and it's hard to move through. Yes, sir? Right, so there's actually a couple reasons for this. So the question is actually rather complex about, was Lincoln very frustrated after this battle? And that easy answer is yes. He said, my God, what will the country say? In short, after this battle, but also then wasn't the objective to get to Richmond, and why the Confederates held this ground so much was because it would have been seen as a very much an outer defense of Richmond. It's only 50 miles away from Richmond. Fredericksburg is a straight line. And so Lincoln is frustrated because he's trying to attack Richmond. And so in some ways, yes, for Lincoln's part of it at least. Lincoln, again, is urging his generals to converge on Richmond, mainly on Lee's army, though. So most of these generals are more focused on Richmond than than Lincoln is. Lincoln's main goal, I think, is to destroy Lee's army. Most of the generals' goal is to capture Richmond. If they can destroy Lee's army in the process, that's great. Right up until you get to Grant and Meade, where they realize destruction of Lee's army is paramount. In terms of why the Confederacy would defend the Fredericksburg area, actually, it's very interesting. They sort of go through this discussion before the Battle of Fredericksburg, in which Lee actually doesn't even intend to hold Fredericksburg. There shouldn't have even been a battle there except for the delay of the pontoon bridges. Lee wants to take up his position along the North Anna River because he sees that as defensible ground, but also ground in which he can crush his opponent. He knows if he defends Fredericksburg, he'll win a victory, but he won't crush his opponent, so he won't get that full victory that he wants. But Jefferson Davis demands that Lee holds Fredericksburg because of essentially Spotsylvania County, all of the ground around it. It's very fertile farmland. Not only that, but the citizens of Fredericksburg, that's a relatively major town in Virginia at the time, politically it's a bad idea to give up Fredericksburg in terms of holding on to fertile grounds and the supplies that the armies will need and that the Confederacy needs. It's a bad idea to give up Fredericksburg. And so they fight for that that particular town. And again, part of the reason that it's such a Union objective too, is the Richmond, Fredericksburg, and Potomac Railroad, which runs through the town of Fredericksburg, could supply an army on its way south. So farther to the west, you have the Orange and Alexandria Railroad, but it's determined that that actually cannot sustain the army. So moving further to the west, really Hooker's only objective in moving west would have to be, again, to move in on Fredericksburg so he can capture that railroad. So kind of a complex, tangled web of answer, but I hope that serves. Yes, sir. All right, so the question for anyone who didn't hear is wondering if part of the delay or the sort of the grinding to a halt of Jackson's attack has anything to do with Jackson's over-ambition or perpetual tardiness or something to that effect. The fact that Jackson is often later than he expects to be, later in arriving than he expects to. And so essentially asking also, are there any delays that he encounters? Are they Jackson's fault? Does that impact the overall impact of Jackson's attack? And I would say yes, most definitely. Firstly, from the very beginning, Jackson intends to leave at 4 a.m. But as soon as he and Lee come up with their plan, he goes to sleep. So he doesn't issue the necessary orders to get his men ready to move by 4 a.m. So when he does wake up, and he doesn't sleep until 4 or anything, but when he does wake up and starts to issue those orders, there's no way that his officers can get his men ready in time. So he doesn't leave until 7 a.m. So that does contribute not only to him being a little tardy, but also in the overall frame of time. You don't have that much time. By the time you march 12 miles in a day, if you don't start until 7, by the time his first couple elements, enough really to attack with, arrive, it is 5:15 in the evening. He doesn't have his full force up because it's taken his men so long to get there. Moreover, he is delayed by something that he really can't help so much, is that his reconnaissance has been only somewhat complete. And so the first route that he intends to take would not actually take him fully onto the flank of the Union Army. It would run him, if you're looking at a map, let me see if I can find a map of this. All right. I don't think I have one. All right, May 2nd map. So where you see below his main force, there's two little squares. There we go. All right, there's two little squares. That's where Jackson first intends to attack, which would have brought him up near where that, where you see Wilderness Church, which means he'd have missed much of Howard's forces. And so he realizes this. His cavalry, Fitz Lee, comes out and says, listen, if you attack there, you're not going to actually outflank them. So there's another way. Let me show you, though, what you'll be attacking if you go the route you intend to. And so they do a personal reconnaissance and see that, in fact, that's not where Jackson wants to go. And so he is delayed because he has to go back to the Brock Road, move his men straight up, and attack down the turnpike. So that's yet another delay that he faces along the way. So by not attacking until 5:15 p.m., that leaves him with just a couple hours left of daylight. Sure, it's May, but it's going to get dark on him pretty quickly. And so that also, I would say, contributes to the difficult situation of attacking with a large front that collapses in on itself repeatedly, in terms of grinding that attack to a halt, because darkness also, of course, contributes to that kind of chaos and confusion that his men face. It also contributes to why he has to stop and sort of reconvene. Yes, sir? The apex of Hooker's last line?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question is, what is the condition of the apex of Hooker's last line? To my knowledge, and you can see it actually if you go to stop number 2 while you're on the driving tour, just look across the road from the Bullock House site, that's where the apex is. To my knowledge, there isn't too much left of that area. The apex is there, so you can see where it sort of comes together. There are some earthworks farther back, so there's a trail that sort of leads off into the woods. You can follow it. I can't speak for the Bob Crick part of the question as to whether or not Bob Crick wasn't interested and thus didn't save it. he does have quite an affinity for Confederate forces. That's very true, but you'll be hard-pressed to find a greater authority on the Army of Northern Virginia. But to my knowledge, the park does not own much of that ground, so we own the apex and just a little ways into the woods, which does still exist, but I'm actually concerned recently. I haven't talked to our cultural resources manager about it yet, but I know they have been cutting down a lot of trees in that area. So I don't know if that means not only is it not in our hands, but it's actually in bad hands. But the apex is still there. It's still somewhat impressive if you do go visit it again, which actually becomes very interesting. And so to let you in on a secret, this talk is actually a tour that I give. It's been kind of modified. But on my tour, we stop there and we say, well, this is the initial site of contact between the forces and the site of the apex of Hooker's last line. It's an interesting juxtaposition. But long story short, the apex is still there. Some of the earthworks are still there, likely what you saw the last time you were there. But I don't know what their future holds. Thank you all.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.